Stay with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sulis. Interested in learning new skills online at a pace that suits you? Visit ecollege.ie to apply for one of our free online courses.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
So it's time now for the Friday gathering, and I'm joined in the studio by Minister for Overseas Aid and Diaspora and Fine Gael TD for Dublin South West, Colin Brophy, Pádraig McLoughlin, Sinn Féin TD for Donegal, and the party spokesperson on fisheries and the marine. Dr. Jennifer Kavanagh is here, law lecturer at the South East Technological University, and Brenda Power, columnist with the Sunday Times and the Irish Daily Mail. Now, before we get to the big stories of the week, well, maybe this is a big story of the week, the Ugandan hurlers. Uganda GAA, Colin, you heard us talking to Moses and John earlier on, and you've been buying hurls for them, have you?
I did hear. It was an amazing story. In actual fact, the strength of the GAA right across Africa has to be seen, because there are not just Irish people playing it, but as you were highlighting there, you know, people get into it, fall into it, meet someone who brings them along to a match or whatever, and all of a sudden you have a whole community playing. So listen, I had a quick word with our ambassador out in Uganda, and we're going to do some funding for them to make sure they have the gear and the equipment and everything else they need. So that'll be coming their way, and they really do deserve it.
It was
such an uplifting interview and story.
Well, they'll appreciate that. And they're also looking for players to send them videos of them playing hurling so they can pick up the skills. It's a fascinating story.
They've been playing with mahogany hurls.
Yeah, mahogany hurls. Yeah.
Imagine how lethal they would be.
And watching on TikTok and picking it up and deciding to go from there. It's
fantastic.
Amazing, really. Now, let's talk about, first of all, this decision by Russia to ban 52 people. I see the list has been published by the Irish Independent. You're not on it, Colin. You're
not on it,
are you?
I don't care one way or the other, to be honest. I mean, I think the list and the whole behaviour of the Russian government is a distraction. It's designed to have us talk about this instead of talk about their barbaric actions, particularly in the last week in Ukraine, where they have been targeting the infrastructure of the country, deliberately designed to try and make sure that people are effectively left freezing for a winter. So that's where our focus should be. And that's where the focus of the government is. And we'll continue to keep that pressure on Russia.
You know, it has resurrected this discussion around whether the Russian ambassador should be allowed to continue to remain on here. And we've Neil Richmond in here, and he firmly believes that he should be taken to the airport and should have been taken to the airport after that meeting in Ivy House yesterday. Pádraig, you don't agree.
I don't agree with that.
I know you don't agree with that, Colin. Pádraig McLoughlin, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I do think the ambassador. I think the ambassador should have been sent packing quite a long time ago. Obviously, he has given testimony to the Oireachtas that, you know, was utterly false. I think that's the invasion of Ukraine and the oppression that they have pushed upon the Ukrainian people is reprehensible. And I think that's, we have independent foreign policy in Ireland.
But you know, argument against sending him away is that the Irish embassy in Moscow would be closed down. There are four staff, I think, there at the moment. You're not concerned about that?
I think the normal rules of diplomacy, Russia's just thrown them away. I mean, there have obviously been all sorts of efforts across the world, not just in terms of the collective West, but countries who have a good relationship with Russia have appealed to them to end the war. So they've rejected diplomacy everywhere you turn. There's always lines of communication you can have. But I think as a country with an independent foreign policy, we may be militarily neutral, but we're not politically neutral. I think it would be a very strong signal if we sent the Russian ambassador packing.
Jennifer?
I think the last thing you do is send the Russian ambassador packing, because as you said, the first thing they'll do is close the Irish embassy, and they will send our ambassador home. And at the end of the day, we have Irish people living in Russia who need consular assistance, who need the embassy assistance. Everything on public international law is based on the basis that whatever you do to a country, they can do back to you. So we know what the Russian ambassador has been saying. We take it with an extremely large pinch of salt. And at the end of the day, we know he will be coming out with the line from the Kremlin. So everyone is aware of that. But you do not send ambassadors home. You do not send them packing. You can send everyone else from the embassy packing and leave the ambassador in place. But you need to keep those lines of communication open. And all those rules to do with ambassadors, all that public international law, it has been set since pretty much the Tudor court, because you need those emissaries who can talk to each other and who are protected as the official person that you can communicate. So the last thing you do is get rid of the ambassador.
Are you nodding in
agreement,
Brenda?
I agree. I agree with Jennifer. I think it would be a big mistake. In terms of propaganda, a propaganda tool to them as well, you know, because, I mean, they already have targeted us as a hostile country. And I think, you know, just do not stoop to their level, really. Correct. Do not. And silencing speech, silencing, even though we know it is propaganda, is never a good idea.
Yeah,
it's
but
never,
Cork says it would send a really strong signal from
what?
Ireland.
But we'd be biting off our nose to bite our face.
But does it send a really strong signal from Ireland? I mean, this is the point. These type of things, and I know, you know, we're going to have an Ordesh Fine Gael this weekend, and we're going to have full discussion on this type of area. We're going to have people with different views. But it usually is, it's a type of simple solution. For one day, you might feel good about yourself. Mm. Wow, we threw the ambassador out. Unfortunately, when they throw our ambassador out the next day, we have our citizens, we have real life issues where we need to maintain a level of contact. Even countries who are directly at war with each other maintain a level of contact. So I think what we need to do, even though it's the tougher thing to do, is to continue to support Ukraine, to absolutely take the comments about the Russian ambassador, you know, absolutely just, you know, he's there. All he's going to do is parrot off some lines that he's been given by the regime back home. But we have to be conscious of the fact that our focus needs to remain on supporting Ukraine and doing everything we can do, and that we should not get distracted, which is what they'd like, basically, is us to be spending our time worrying about whether or not we're chucking out the ambassador.
Mark, what do you say to that, just before we leave it, that, you know, it's playing into their hands?
I think I have to say, when you look at international conflict resolution, I think particularly of Israel-Palestine, and I think of words, you know, words, but hardly ever actions, and you abandon a whole people there. And I think sometimes actions have to, you know, have to match the words that you've used. There will always be lines of communication. I'm not suggesting that we have no lines of communication with Russia. You know, we're hoping to be involved in conflict resolution. If you look at Ireland, because we're militarily neutral, we've been able to play a role in conflict resolution in Colombia, Sri Lanka, the Basque Country, and I think we could play an even. I also want to say, which is really important, the role of our UN peacekeepers. You know, because we are militarily neutral, the reason why we're on the UN Security Council is because of our independent foreign policy, and sometimes you have to use it and use it effectively.
All right.
I think your suggestion, Jennifer, of sending home a large tranche of the staff who are there, because that is clearly a sort of an intelligence hub. They have, I think, 30 staff there. Why do they need 30 staff in Ireland? And leave the ambassador there on his own, making his own.
It was described on the programme yesterday as a listening post. Mm. In a strategic
position. Well, every embassy is meant to be a listening post in a way of seeing what's going on, the culture, getting the information back.
I think the suggestion was that it goes beyond that.
Oh, of course, But at the end of the day, if you do throw out an ambassador, remember there are privileged communications that happen between embassies and the relevant Department of Foreign Affairs. If you have that gone, they could technically be checking everything that is going back to Ireland. So you lose all that communications that has that kind of privilege on it.
Okay, let's move on now to another story which was in the headlines, not just this week, but the week before as well, after the RT Radio 1 documentary about child abuse in Blackrock College. Pádraig, I'll start with you on this one. We know the government now hasn't ruled out a public inquiry. The position seems to have shifted a little bit since this first started to emerge. What's the Sinn Féin position on this?
Well, I think the first thing is that you need to have a situation with a Taoiseach and the relevant ministers, that would be Education, Justice, Children, would meet with the victims. We need to learn from the Mother and Baby Homes experience, where that should have been victim-centred. So I think that's your starting point.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think that has been said, though, certainly in the last day or so, that will happen.
If victims want a public inquiry, I think that's what you work. But let them, you know, direct the traffic in terms of what needs to happen. And of course, you have ongoing criminal prosecutions. So you need to find that balance of getting to the truth and making sure that criminal prosecutions can proceed.
Brenda?
Yeah, I mean, that's the concern. And I suppose, like most people, my view would be this should primarily be a criminal investigation. And you don't want anything that might potentially prejudice that going forward. I can completely understand why the victims want a victim-led inquiry would seem to be the way to go. Mm-hmm. But I think in the first instance, if there are people around who help to cover this up and there is any possibility of bringing them to justice, then that should be a priority.
Can those two processes not happen in tandem, though?
Well, you see, there would always be a risk, and Jennifer, you'd know more about this, of something emerging in the course of an investigation like that that might prejudice a prosecution. Mm. And I think that should be, I mean, bringing people to justice, I would say that that would be the victim's objective as well, primary objective in any scenario.
Yeah, see, normally in these cases, the criminal process will take precedence over everything else that's going on. Mm. But there's been a number of cases which have related to child sexual abuse to do with orders whereby it happened 50 years ago and they don't actually want to prosecute because, look, people don't know what they had for breakfast a month ago. Yeah. They're not going to remember the minutia to a legal standard of what happened almost 50 years ago. So it has to be centred on the victims. We've had the absolute disaster that was the mother and baby home situation where people were giving testimony and it was not given the proper weight. And at the end of the day, the people who have suffered the most are the ones that have to be taken into the thought process of how do we deal with this effectively. And that's what they have to work on. And the other thing that I find is striking, and you did say it yourself, is that with the people who have suffered in this particular instance, if you compare it, say, to people who went through industrial schools, what went through the Ryan Report, the mother and baby homes, the kind of narrative and believing of the victims in this situation is actually totally different. And I don't want to be totally cynical and say maybe it's different socio-demographic backgrounds and the like, but people need to be listened to and they need to drive these processes mm-hmm. because otherwise you will never get any sort of resolution.
Do you not think, though, that it's because we have been through the Ryan Report? We have been through so many years of this now that as soon as somebody comes forward, they are believed.
Yeah, and I mean, even going back as far as Ferns and everything, but there has been learnings from what has happened. But I mean, this has been going on for 20 years. And is it just now that we're so practically 20 years into this that we're believing people? We should have been believing people from the minute that this started. Mm-hmm. And yes, we learned how to go about these processes. And the other issue is the non-disclosure agreements. Mm. If there's any sort of criminality, people should not be silenced by agreements. It doesn't seem to be happening in this case. But the use of these non-disclosure agreements in all workplaces, it is an issue that if things are being covered up and people can't understand what's happening or even just get foresight of something that may be coming down the road, there are also issues as well.
Colin Brophy, how should the government respond?
Well, I personally would like to see an inquiry. I think based on what the same parameters that we've all talked about here so far, I think, though, the criminal prosecution of and when it is required should take that priority. I think it is really important that every aspect, and particularly every aspect of any cover-up or any effort by people to facilitate, needs to be investigated and needs to be investigated by and in a criminal setting. But as a general principle in terms of making sure that if people want to, and if people who are victims want to have their voice heard or their story told, that it is facilitated to them. And if that means there should be an inquiry, then there should be an inquiry.
But not just facilitated, it's not just treated as hearsay or a story, as has happened in previous investigations.
I agree, but I agree that also with your earlier point that what we did in the past was totally unacceptable, but I do think we have learned and I do think things have changed in a long way over the last 20 odd years in terms of how we listen to people. And I think there's much more of, as your point, Claire, was there a willingness to believe from the start. It's quite amazing when you think back to the attitudes or listen back to some of the contemporaries' commentary at the time of how people weren't believed, how literally, collectively, we did not believe. And yeah, we really...
But yet, Colm, I mean, there is the presumption of innocence that we attach to anybody.
I absolutely agree. And I think that's the problem with the criminal side element of prosecutions, that it is very, very difficult to bring criminal cases over a long time period and to have them. But I also think that balance can be reached. I mean, that's why you have structures in place. That is why you legislate, and it takes time to put in place the correct structures that allow both someone to be heard and obviously supply an element of the safeguards that are necessary. But we just realistically, we have to make sure that people are given that opportunity.
All right, we'll leave that one there. We move on to the story on the front page of the Mail. Toll rises, gouging us in inverted commas. Anger at surprise highway robbery as road charges are hiked. Brenda, your advice is if you don't like the tolls, don't use the toll
roads. You don't like the toll, that would always have been your option, of course. But now you see what they're calculating into the mix here is that it's going to cost you X amount extra in petrol to avoid the toll. And the only reason I can't see any justification in the coverage in the Mail today for this or any explanation for it other than because we can. Mm-hmm. And it's 20 cent, I think. It's 20 cent on cars, which is what's going to concern, I suppose, most people. Obviously, the goods vehicles and so on will have an even bigger hit. But, I mean, I suppose the option of not taking the motorway becomes all the more expensive mm-hmm. when petrol is at the price it
they're
is.
They're also safer. You know, the bigger roads are safer. Yeah. And we heard that from the journalist Bob Flavin yesterday. And he was explaining there's a lot of maintenance work to be mm-hmm. done to keep them to the standard that we would expect. And, of course, they have wages and so on to pay. Yeah. But are you saying
so they're calculating into this hike the fact that people will do the math and decide it's still going to work out cheaper mm-hmm. to pay the extra. Yeah, which you do have that option, yes, you do.
Pori, people seem to be, from the response to these increases, like really offended almost that this is happening now because we have the increased fuel prices as well and all of the other cost of living increases. You're calling for tolls to be scrapped.
Yeah, I think particularly if you're a commuter coming into Dublin and you're having to go through all the various toll roads every day back and forth, it's a huge cost. There's a couple of things. I mean, obviously, we would have concerns about the historic public-private partnership model anyway. There was a lack of confidence in the state to roll out that infrastructure, and we pay the cost. Of course, these companies were assisted financially during the pandemic because there was less cars on the road. They actually got assistance. The company that operates the M3 have reported a substantial profit recently. So I think the minister has to intervene. I think he has to make it clear that, you know, this increase can't go ahead. I also would say this. I think there should be a review of the whole project because people, you know, may well try to avoid the tolls. They work their way into the smaller roads. That builds up congestion, road safety mm-hmm. issue on those roads. So, you know, this is
not... that's happening anyway, yeah. even pre-increase.
Yeah, the whole thing needs to be reviewed, I really do. Mm-hmm.
Do you like tolls, Jennifer?
Well, I'm always on motorways. I have that tag, which is very, very handy. But it's what really gets me about it is that all these villages and towns have had their lives back because there's been bypasses, a lot like Fermoy, there's a toll on it, and they will get completely log jammed again. When we want to be taking cars out of city centres, we want to be, you know, having more open space for people coming in on their bikes, people just sitting out having a cup of coffee, reclaiming the streets. That the whole idea of increasing the price of the toll, you know, if it's only going to be 20 cent, it's not going to be that much, but if you're constantly using them, it will be a lot. Mm. And I think it's just the totally wrong idea to put up the price to put people back on the roads that had got the life back mm-hmm. into them because they had the bypass.
It won't. A year ago it might have when petrol was cheaper. But given the price of petrol now, it just mm-hmm. won't be worth your while to go back through the secondary roads.
People just won't pay a toll to begin with. They still go the old road.
People do usually... they might change a bit, but they pay the tolls, and that's what's wrong about this, and that's why I believe it needs... It's not a government decision, it's a decision of Transport Infrastructure Ireland.
Government wasn't told about it, it seems.
Absolutely, and I think these guys should cop themselves on and reverse the decision. I think there's a special situation when you have a charge that you're imposing on a road structure where people... yes, some people can go onto alternate roads, but a lot of people are forced to use them and use them on a daily basis, and it's a real cost. And if you look at what people are facing into in terms of cost of living, mm-hmm. I think this is absolutely the wrong decision. And I think the smart thing they can do, they're coming in before the Transport Committee, and they can maybe, you know, wake themselves up a little bit and come in and announce that they have changed their mind mm-hmm. and they're going to recognise the situation that exists there and not put this charge.
You're calling for a full reversal.
I don't see any grounds at all. I've yet to see, apart from some blah blah statements about costs of infrastructure and roads and bitumen and stuff, in any way an explanation from them that justifies their thinking in putting up this charge. And I think the, you know, yes, obviously you need road maintenance, you need everything, there's not
a bottomless... Yeah, I mean, they do say, their statement
said I understand.
They're being driven by the current rate of inflation. So everybody is experiencing that problem.
And every business is experiencing that. And there are businesses the length and breadth of this country every single day with rising costs coming into them who can't pass that on or are not passing it on to the full extent. And I think a little bit of that commercial thinking by this crowd would be a good idea, and saying, look, yes, we recognise that we have increased costs and maybe we'll have to do a little less this year in terms of our maintenance programme, but we're not going to pass that cost on. Mm-hmm. I'd really ask them to think about this again.
Porky, you must welcome that now today.
Yeah, no, I actually agree with Colm. I don't think there's any justification. But as I say, I think this is an opportunity to not just for the minister to appeal to them, to on the record appeal to them not to go ahead with it, to both the TII and the private companies. But I think it's an opportunity to review the overall policy.
The other thing I wanted to touch on before we finish, I'm watching the clock here, the death of Vicky Phelan. And I'm conscious as well that, you know, we're talking about this and she's a national figure, but there's a family who are grieving the loss of a mother and a wife and a sister and a daughter. But what sticks in my mind, and Brenda, you're writing about Vicky today, you know, she was this national figure who everybody is lauding and heartfelt tributes paid to her, of course, this week. But she is somebody who wanted to get things done. And the only reason that we know about her is because she was a campaigner. And there are certain things that are not done that she wanted to see complete in relation to open disclosure, which is still under discussion. And they would be the fitting tributes, really.
Yes, although, I mean, obviously it is legally very fraught. I mean, I saw the reservations that have been expressed about this full disclosure in circumstances where I think it's discrepancies or I'm not sure what the phrase used is,
discordance
emerges in a look back on files. And I mean, the point being made that is not necessarily always a result of negligence. Mm-hmm. It could just be the limitations of the system. And you just, what you don't want is to sort of spark a glut of medical negligence claims that don't have any real foundation in actual shortcomings or failings. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very difficult line to tread. I mean, the situation that obtained when she was denied the knowledge of the omissions in her case was absolutely unacceptable and couldn't have survived. But we have to be careful to not overdo and in fairness to medical professionals, most of whom are doing their best in often very straitened circumstances, to sort of create the impression that these mistakes are being made willy-nilly by just negligence and incompetence. I don't think that's the case.
On the personal side, you didn't meet Vicky Phelan, but you've written about her today and you've written about the work that she did. I know that you read her book and you watched what she was doing over the course of her life, and you admired the fact that she was very open about planning her funeral and what would happen after her own death. And I think your take is that we should all be doing that. We should take that opportunity.
Apparently we should. And it's something nobody likes to talk about. I was looking at statistics that suggest only 30% of Irish people have a will made. So we can't contemplate. It's very, very difficult. And she had no option but to do that. And she did it in full public glare. And she talked this time last year about how she had decided that she was not going to go for whatever extra time the further bout of chemo would have bought her. She was going to concentrate her last energies on enjoying time with her family. And I mean, we boast about doing death well in this country. In fact, we don't really. We do a great send-off, we do a great party, but we don't actually confront the reality of it. And I mean, if there's one lesson, there's lots of lessons that she's taught us, but one is, like, accept that this is going to happen and maybe, you know, have the discussions and say the things that you need to say.
And I know everyone around the table would want to pay tribute to Vicky Phelan. We don't have time to do that, but I know her family know that the whole country is thinking about them as they go through this difficult time. We're going to take a break. Thank you all very much.
Today with Clareburn. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player app.